death and consciousness. Two pretty big topics for a deep dive, right?
Yeah, no kidding. Big questions, but that's kind of my jam.
Well, you've definitely come to the right place. Today, we're diving into a whole bunch of research on what neuroscience is telling us about what happens to the brain when we die.
And what that might mean for consciousness itself. It's pretty fascinating stuff.
Definitely fascinating, and more than a little bit eerie, if you ask me.
Well, sure. I mean, it's not exactly light dinner conversation, is it? But it's those big questions, the ones that make us kind of squirm a bit, that often lead to the most amazing discoveries.
You got that right. So where do we even begin with a topic like this? It's not like we can hit rewind on the experience of death, can we?
Not literally, of course, but no. We can look at what happens in the brain as it shuts down, which is kind of like hitting rewind. At least in a way.
Okay, I'm following. So walk me through it. What's actually happening up there in those final moments?
Well, even before the heart actually stops, you start to see a decrease in blood flow to the brain. And less blood flow means less oxygen getting to those brain cells.
And that can't be good.
Not good at all. That drop in oxygen, even if it's subtle, can cause changes in brain activity. It might even lead to some early changes in awareness.
So even before what we typically think of as the moment of death, things are already shifting in the brain.
Exactly. And then within about 4 minutes of the heart stopping, things get really dire. See, the brain has these energy stores, but they're surprisingly limited. When the heart stops, those stores are quickly depleted.
Like a power outage for the brain.
A massive power outage. And unfortunately, the backup generators are, well, there are no backup generators. And between 4 and 10 minutes after the heart stops, a whole cascade of events starts happening. It's like a domino effect. That delicate balance of electrolytes in the brain, what we call ionic balance, gets totally thrown off.
So the brain's electrical system basically goes haywire.
Exactly. And then to make matters worse, you get this surge of different neurochemicals flooding the brain. And unfortunately, this is the point where a lot of the damage becomes irreversible.
So it's not just the lights going out. It's more like the whole electrical grid going down for good.
And what about the brain waves themselves, those electrical patterns we can see on an EEG? What happens to them during this process?
Well, you see some pretty dramatic changes in the brainwave patterns as death approaches.
Mm.
In the first 10 to 30 minutes or so, those high-frequency waves, the ones associated with conscious thought and awareness, they transition to these much slower, more erratic patterns.
A clear sign of a brain shutting down.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that this isn't an instantaneous thing. Death, it's a process with a lot of steps, unfortunately.
So given that it's a process, not an on-off switch, does that mean there's any chance of reversing things once that shutdown process starts? Like, is there any coming back from this?
It's a question a lot of people have, and it's where this idea of a wave of resuscitation comes into play. A wave of resuscitation. I've never heard of that. Tell me more.
So basically, if reoxygenation happens extremely quickly after the brain's electrical activity goes quiet, there might be like this tiny window where some very basic brain functions could theoretically be jump-started.
You mean like a flicker of activity on a heart monitor, something that could potentially be revived?
Kind of, yeah. But there are a lot of caveats here. First, even if this wave of resuscitation is successful, the degree of recovery would likely be very limited. And the chances of someone going through this and not having severe neurological impairment are, well, they're not good.
So even if the brain gets a little blip of activity back, it's not necessarily a guarantee of anything close to a full recovery.
Sadly, that's about the size of it.
Okay, so that's a lot to process, but it's important information to have. Now, in doing my research for this deep dive, I came across something that totally blew my mind. These gamma wave surges that happen right before death. What's the deal with those?
Yeah. That's some of the most interesting research happening in this field right now. Gamma waves, those are those high-frequency brain waves, the ones that are firing away like crazy when we're conscious and really using our brains.
Right. Like right now, our gamma waves are probably going nuts.
Probably. But to see those same gamma waves surge as the brain is otherwise shutting down, as it's dying, well, it's a fascinating paradox, to say the least.
So what's the explanation? What's causing this surge of activity right before the end?
Well, there are a few different theories floating around out there. Some researchers think it could be a last-ditch effort by the brain, a kind of survival mechanism where it's trying to kickstart itself even as it's losing power.
So like a final burst of energy before the lights go out for good.
Yeah, kind of like that. But then there's another theory that I find even more intriguing, which is that this gamma wave surge could actually be a form of memory replay.
Wait, like those life flashing before your eyes stories you hear about? You're saying there might be some scientific basis for that.
We can't say for sure, of course, But it's a fascinating possibility, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder about those near-death experiences that some people report, those glimpses into what might lie beyond. What's the science say about those?
Well, ethically speaking, we can't exactly replicate a near-death experience in the lab.
Yeah, that would be a tough one to get past the ethics board.
For sure. But we can look at what happens in the brain when people experience something similar to what's described in near-death experiences. And what we're finding is, well, it's pretty remarkable, to be honest.
All right, I'm all ears. Tell me everything.
No.
What are we learning about these experiences and where they come from in the brain?
So there's this area of the brain called the temporoparietal junction, TPJ for short. It plays a crucial role in how you perceive your own body in space, that sense of where you end and the world begins.
Okay, so like when you're walking in a dream and your legs feel like they're made of jelly, that kind of blurred boundary.
Exactly. But imagine that feeling of blurred boundaries, but instead of jelly legs, you feel like you're floating above your own body, watching yourself from outside. Researchers have actually been able to trigger these out-of-body experiences in control settings just by stimulating the TPJ.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
You can induce an out-of-body experience just by stimulating a specific part of the brain. That's wild.
It really is. And it just goes to show how much of what we experience is really just the brain's interpretation of sensory information. If you can manipulate that sensory information in the right way, well, you can manipulate the experience itself.
Mind-blowing. So it's like tricking the brain into thinking it's somewhere else, even if the body's still right there in the lab.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it's not just the TPJ either. There's another area, the angular gyrus, which is also involved in how we process our sense of self and our body in space.
And like the TPJ, stimulating the angular gyrus can also trigger an out-of-body experience.
You got it. It's like there are multiple pathways in the brain that can lead to that same extraordinary experience.
That's incredible. So we've got these regions of the brain, the TPJ, the angular gyrus, that seem to be involved in those out-of-body sensations people report during near-death experiences. But what about the other stuff people describe, like feeling a presence or seeing a bright light? Is there a brain region for that too?
This is where things get really interesting. Researchers have been using this technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, to stimulate a different part of the brain, the right temporal lobe.
The right temporal lobe. I think I remember reading about that. It's involved in memory and maybe even spiritual experiences, right?
Exactly. And get this. Stimulating the right temporal lobe has caused people to report feeling a presence in the room, even when they were completely alone. They've described seeing lights, feeling an overwhelming sense of peace, even having these profound spiritual experiences.
Wow. It's amazing and a little spooky how we can seemingly replicate these elements of a near-death experience just by, you know, poking around in the brain with a little bit of electricity.
It really is. And it raises some pretty big questions about the nature of these experiences. Does it mean that near-death experiences are nothing more than a brain misfire?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is. And it's important to remember that just because we can find a correlation between brain activity and these experiences, it doesn't necessarily diminish their significance or invalidate the very real emotions and insights that people gain from them.
That's a really good point. It's about respecting the experience while also appreciating the science behind it. So we've talked about the dying brain. We've touched on these mind-blowing near-death experiences. But now I want to dive into the heart of it all, consciousness itself. What exactly is this thing?
That is the ultimate question, isn't it? And even with all the progress that neuroscience has made, defining and explaining consciousness is still one of the biggest challenges we face. It's such a slippery concept.
So it's not like we can just point to a specific spot in the brain and say, aha, there's consciousness.
If only it were that simple. Consciousness seems to be more about the complex interplay of different brain regions, the way those areas communicate and work together, almost like a symphony orchestra, creating a single, unified sound.
Okay, I like that analogy. So instead of a solo instrument, it's the entire orchestra working in harmony that creates the music of our minds.
Exactly, you're getting it. And while pinpointing the exact source of consciousness remains a challenge, we can look at which regions of the brain, when they shut down at death, are most closely tied to that loss of consciousness.
Okay, so which parts of the brain are we talking about here?
Well, at the top of the list, you've got the cerebral cortex, the thinking part of our brain. This is the command center for awareness, perception, language, all the things we consider essential to being human. So when the cortex shuts down, that's a major blow to consciousness.
Makes sense. No more thinking, no more you, essentially.
Pretty much. But it's not just the cortex. The thalamus is another crucial player. It's like grand central station for your senses, taking in all that information from the outside world and then sending it on to the cortex for processing. The thalamus is also crucial for maintaining wakefulness.
So it's not just about thinking, but also about being aware of what's happening around us.
Exactly. And then there's the brainstem, which is like the oldest, most primitive part of our brain. It controls those vital functions we don't even think about breathing. Heart rate and damage to the brainstem often has a huge impact on consciousness.
It's fascinating how all these different parts of the brain, from the high-level thinking of the cortex to those basic survival mechanisms in the brainstem, are all intertwined with this thing we call consciousness.
Yeah.
But if it's so complex, so interconnected, how do we even begin to study it?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. One area of research that's been providing some surprising insights is the study of general anesthesia.
Wait, anesthesia? The stuff they give you before surgery so you don't feel anything? How does that help us understand consciousness?
Think about it this way. General anesthesia is, in a sense, the opposite of consciousness. It's a controlled and reversible way to temporarily switch off awareness.
So by studying how anesthesia works, we might learn something about how consciousness works.
Exactly. And what we're finding is that different anesthetics seem to disrupt consciousness by disrupting the communication between different brain regions. It's not so much about shutting down one specific area as it is about interfering with the flow of information between areas.
So going back to that orchestra analogy, it's like messing with the timing between the musicians. The music, if you can even call it that anymore, just falls apart.
Perfect analogy. And the more we understand about how these brain networks communicate, the closer we might get to understanding how that activity gives rise to the subjective experience of consciousness.
So we may not have cracked the code of consciousness just yet, but research into the dying brain, near-death experiences, even anesthesia, it's all giving us more pieces of the puzzle. It really makes you think about those big questions we started with. What is consciousness and what happens when we die?
It certainly does. And while we may never have all the answers, the journey of exploring these questions is, in my opinion, just as fascinating, if not more so, than the answers themselves.
I couldn't agree more. And for you listening, we'll leave you with this final thought. If we could develop the technology to accurately decode someone's subjective experiences from their brain activity, would that change how you view consciousness, death, or even the meaning of life itself? Food for thought as you navigate your own fascinating existence. Until next time, keep those brains buzzing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating possibility, isn't it?
It really is. And it makes you wonder about those near-death experiences that some people report, those glimpses into what might lie beyond. What's the science about those?
Well, ethically speaking, we can't exactly replicate a near-death experience in the lab.
Yeah, that would be a tough one to get past the ethics board.
For sure. But we can look at what happens in the brain when people experience something similar to what's described in near-death experiences. And what we're finding is, well, it's pretty remarkable, to be honest.
All right, I'm all ears. Tell me everything. What are we learning about these experiences and where they come from in the brain?
So there's this area of the brain called the temporoparietal junction, TPJ for short. It plays a crucial role in how you perceive your own body in space, that sense of where you end and the world begins.
Okay, so like when you're walking in a dream and your legs feel like they're made of jelly, that kind of blurred boundary.
Exactly. But imagine that feeling of blurred boundaries, but instead of jelly legs, you feel like you're floating above your own body, watching yourself from outside. Researchers have actually been able to trigger these out-of-body experiences in controlled settings just by stimulating the TPJ.
Wait, seriously?
Yeah.
You can induce an out-of-body experience just by stimulating a specific part of the brain. That's wild.
It really is, and it just goes to show how much of what we experience is really just the brain's interpretation of sensory information. If you can manipulate that sensory information in the right way, well, you can manipulate the experience itself.
Mind-blowing. So it's like tricking the brain into thinking it's somewhere else, even if the body's still right there in the lab.
Precisely. And it's not just the TPJ either. There's another area, the angular gyrus, which is also involved in how we process our sense of self and our body in space.
And like the TPJ stimulating the angular gyrus can also trigger an out-of-body experience.
You got it. It's like there are multiple pathways in the brain that can lead to that same extraordinary experience.
That's incredible. So we've got these regions of the brain, the TPJ, the angular gyrus, that seem to be involved in those out-of-body sensations people report during near-death experiences. But what about the other stuff people describe, like feeling a presence or seeing a bright light? Is there a brain region for that too?
This is where things get really interesting. Researchers have been using this technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, to stimulate a different part of the brain, the right temporal lobe.
The right temporal lobe? I think I remember reading about that. It's involved in memory and maybe even spiritual experiences, right?
Exactly. And get this, stimulating the right temporal lobe has caused people to report feeling a presence in the room, even when they were completely alone. They've described seeing lights, feeling an overwhelming sense of peace, even having these profound spiritual experiences.
Wow. It's amazing and a little spooky how we can seemingly replicate these elements of a near-death experience just by, you know, poking around in the brain with a little bit of electricity.
It really is. And it raises some pretty big questions about the nature of these experiences. Does it mean that near-death experiences are nothing more than a brain misfire?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is. And it's important to remember that just because we can find a correlation between brain activity and these experiences, it doesn't necessarily diminish their significance or invalidate the very real emotions and insights that people gain from them.
That's a really good point. It's about respecting the experience while also appreciating the science behind it. So we've talked about the dying brain, we've touched on these mind-blowing near-death experiences, but now I want to dive into the heart of it all, consciousness itself. What exactly is this thing?
That is the ultimate question, isn't it? And even with all the progress that neuroscience has made, defining and explaining consciousness is still one of the biggest challenges we face. It's such a slippery concept.
So it's not like we could just point to a specific spot in the brain and say, aha, there's consciousness.
If only it were that simple. Consciousness seems to be more about the complex interplay of different brain regions, the way those areas communicate and work together, almost like a symphony orchestra creating a single unified sound.
Okay, well, I'd like that analogy. So instead of a solo instrument, it's the entire orchestra working in harmony that creates the music of our minds.
Exactly. You're getting it. And while pinpointing the exact source of consciousness remains a challenge, we can look at which regions of the brain, when they shut down at death, are most closely tied to that loss of consciousness.
Okay, so which parts of the brain are we talking about here?
Well, at the top of the list, you've got the cerebral cortex, the thinking part of our brain. This is the command center for awareness, perception, language, all the things we consider essential to being human. So when the cortex shuts down, that's a major blow to consciousness.
Makes sense. No more thinking, no more you, essentially.
Pretty much. But it's not just the cortex. The thalamus is another crucial player. It's like Grand Central Station for your senses, taking in all that information from the outside world and then sending it onto the cortex for processing. The thalamus is also crucial for maintaining wakefulness.
So it's not just about thinking, but also about being aware of what's happening around us.
Exactly. And then there's the brainstem, which is like the oldest, most primitive part of our brain. It controls those vital functions we don't even think about. Breathing, heart rate, and damage to the brainstem often has a huge impact on consciousness.
It's fascinating how all these different parts of the brain, from the high-level thinking of the cortex to those basic survival mechanisms in the brainstem, are all intertwined with this thing we call consciousness. But if it's so complex, so interconnected, how do we even begin to study it?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. One area of research that's been providing some surprising insights is the study of general anesthesia.
Wait, anesthesia? The stuff they give you before surgery so you don't feel anything? How does that help us understand consciousness?
Think about it this way. General anesthesia is, in a sense, the opposite of consciousness. It's a controlled and reversible way to temporarily switch off awareness.
So by studying how anesthesia works, we might learn something about how consciousness works. And what we're finding is that different anesthetics seem to disrupt consciousness by disrupting the communication between different brain regions. It's not so much about shutting down one specific area as it is about interfering with the flow of information between areas.
Right. It's about disrupting those lines of communication, those neural pathways that allow different parts of the brain to talk to each other. And when those lines get crossed, well, consciousness seems to take a hit.
So going back to that orchestra analogy again, it's like messing with the timing between the musicians. The music, if you can even call it that anymore, just falls apart.
Exactly. And the more we understand about how these brain networks communicate, the closer we might get to understanding how that activity gives rise to the subjective experience of consciousness, you know, what it actually feels like to be conscious.
Okay, so we're seeing that consciousness is less about a specific location and more about the coordinated activity across these different brain regions. But there's still this big question of how that activity actually creates the experience of being conscious, right?
You've hit on what philosophers and scientists call the hard problem of consciousness. It's like this. Imagine you're trying to explain the taste of chocolate to someone who's never tasted it before. You could describe the chemical compounds, the way it melts on your tongue, even the specific neurons firing in your brain when you eat it.
But none of that would actually convey the subjective experience of what chocolate tastes like.
Exactly. We can correlate brain activity with conscious states, but explaining why those states feel the way they do, why there's a subjective experience at all, that's the hard problem.
It's like we're missing a piece of the puzzle. We can see the shape of it, we know it fits, but we don't know what the picture on that piece actually is.
Perfect analogy. And this is where things get really interesting, because even though we can't fully grasp the what is it like of consciousness, there are ways to learn more by looking at it from different angles, like by the anesthesia research we were just talking about.
Okay, I love a good perspective shift.
Yeah.
So how does anesthesia research help us tackle this hard problem of consciousness?
Well, remember we were saying how general anesthesia is kind of like temporarily switching off awareness?
Right, like a controlled blackout for your brain.
Exactly. So by studying how different anesthetics disrupt specific brain functions, by looking at which neural pathways are disrupted, we gain valuable insights into what's essential for consciousness to emerge in the first place.
So by taking it apart, by seeing what happens when it's gone, we might understand how it gets put together.
You got it. It's like trying to understand how a car engine works by taking it apart piece by piece. You might not be able to build a whole new engine from scratch, but you'll have a much better understanding of how all the parts fit together.
I like it. So we may not have cracked the code of consciousness just yet, but research into the dying brain, near-death experiences, even anesthesia, it's all giving us more pieces of the puzzle.
It really is fascinating stuff, and it all circles back to those big, enduring questions about the nature of consciousness, the meaning of death, what it all means.
It certainly does. And while we may never have all the answers, the journey of exploring these questions, digging into the research, grappling with the mysteries, well, that's part of what makes life so interesting, wouldn't you say?
I couldn't agree more. The more we learn, the more we realize how much we don't know. But that's okay. It just keeps things interesting.
Absolutely. And for you listening, we'll leave you with this final thought. If we could develop the technology to accurately decode someone's subjective experiences from their brain activity, would that change how you view consciousness, death, or even the meaning of life itself? Something to ponder, right?
Definitely. And maybe even a little bit scary when you really think about it. But hey, who said exploring the mysteries of the brain was going to be easy?
Exactly. It's a wild ride, this whole consciousness thing, but someone's got to do it. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into death, the brain, and the enigma that is consciousness. Until next time, keep those brains buzzing.